I'm so sorry. Can I reach over and just you're not totally on beam with your microphone.
Holy shit. I can't believe you're doing this.
Okay, there. You were just a little off axis. Here, wait. I'll show you. You were kind of over here and now you're here. Like
you guys, this is the ultimate Ira Glass moment. How to Be Amazing, brought to you by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. The thing that surprised me most about my guest today when I first met him is how tall he is. And he's not exceptionally tall. He's not like 6'7 or 6'10 or anything like that. But when people meet actors, they often comment about how short they are. Or even if they aren't short, people always expect actors to be taller than they are. I get that routinely. But with radio, and my hypothesis here is it's because it's such an intimate medium, because you're in somebody's ear, that you sort of expect its celebrities to be on the smaller side. So I remember being a little surprised when I met him, but then he opened his mouth and there was that familiar voice. And I think of his voice as the personification of somebody opening the door for you. And in a metaphoric sense, that is what Ira Glass does. For the past 21 years on This American Life, Ira opens the door for millions of listeners who pass through to find stories that are provocative, poignant, often hilarious. He is often a film producer, he's a writer, he's a media mogul, and now an accomplished dancer. And he does all of this while being above average in height. Ira Glass, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
It's very nice to be here. That was a very nice introduction.
Thanks. How tall are you?
I am 6 feet tall.
Yeah. Now, what's funny about that is as I was writing this introduction, in my head, you were at least 6'3".
Wait, how tall are you?
I'm 5'10". But then you walked in today and I'm like, oh, he's really not as tall. Like now I had built you up in my head as being even taller than you are.
Right. And I'm shrinking too. Like I'm at an age where I'm starting to shrink.
Well, so you're not a young man anymore.
Yeah, no, I'm very old.
You're compressing by the moment. Gravity is shrinking you.
Yeah. Fortunately, I made that deal where my voice stayed very young. So I sound like I'm 23, but in fact, I'm very, very old.
You describe every week. Now, I'm not going to bother explaining This American Life to my audience, because the assumption is if you found this, surely you know This American Life.
In other words, if you're on this like little side road,
that's right,
in the American podcasting business, truly at some point you've been on the I-95.
On the superhighway.
How did you get to this road without going on that road?
That's
first?
What I'm imagining.
Wow.
I'm hoping that it's not true for some people. I'm hoping
that
people just found me first, and maybe they'll discover you through me, but I seriously doubt it.
You're independently famous, though. You're a famous person that people could come through your own
sure.
fame.
Sure, let's go with that. On This American Life, every week, you introduce the episode by saying it's This American Life. Each week on This American Life, we present a story based on a theme. Yeah, and we presented an axe.
Today on our program, people get stuck even when the signs are not looking so very good for them at all. From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Equine, Jesse's girl. So here's a great example.
It feels like a somewhat glib explanation for what This American Life is, because it's really not that. And the show is much deeper than that. And I was wondering if you had a more private definition of what This American Life is, even if it's just a personal definition.
That's a really good question. I mean, sometimes on the staff, we talk about how all the themes are a front, because actually every single theme is the same and every single story is the same story, which is, I thought it was going to go this way, but then it went this way instead. Like that's actually, and like every theme, it could just be that theme every week and it would totally work as a show. So there's that. And when I think about what the show is, like I don't think about the themes at all. The themes are just like the package in a way. And what the show is, like what we're looking for, what I'm looking for, and the staff is looking for, is we're looking for stories in the most like old-fashioned sense, that it's narrative, that it'll be journalism where the stories unfold like a great movie or something. And so they start at one point and they go and you get caught up in the characters. You want to find out what happens, and then things happen and things are surprising. And then the way we think about what we're making is the plot of it has to be surprising. And then it has to drive at some idea that about what happened that doesn't have to be profound, but it has to be at least interesting.
So why don't you just say that every week?
Do you think that would work?
I know it would work, Ira.
I could run it for you right now. Each week on our show, we look for narratives. And then there's going to be an idea at the end. Today's show. Yeah, I thought it was going to be one way. And then if you put a little plinky plinky music underneath that, it totally would work. Yeah, I think that would totally work.
You mentioned the word journalism as it refers to This American Life.
You said that whereas if you had to like put on gloves and hold the word up.
Because
the word journalism.
Yes, because yes. I'm going to hold it up and examine it the way a doctor examines an X-ray, not because I question the veracity of the word. I want to talk about the word because I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, that journalism has played an increasingly prominent role in the show, as opposed to when I first became aware of it, when I felt like it was more first-person narratives and almost essay storytelling.
Yeah. No, you've definitely perceived that correctly. I mean, at the beginning, when the show first went on the air in 1995, it was journalism, but what was new about the show is that there was journalism applied to stories that were so personal that in the past, I think journalists wouldn't have done them. And we had a lot of writers like David Sedaris, and David Rakoff and people who were writing first person sort of accounts of their lives way more than we do now. And what happened in those 20 years is memoir just became a phenomenon. And so everybody was writing about themselves. And the internet happened where people are constantly writing about themselves. And so for us on the staff, it started to seem a little passé to have so many personal stories and personal essayists, even though some of them are amazing. Like it just felt like that shouldn't be what the show is. And also, as the staff got better at doing hardcore investigative journalism in the style of our own show, like that is to tackle, you know, the same things that the serious news people tackle, but to do stories in our style about those stories. As we got better at that, we just wanted to do that more and more. That just became interesting to the staff. And at some level, the show exists for our amusement as a staff. Like basically, like as a staff, it's like, what do we like doing? What do we think would be fun to put on the air? And then I feel like the show gets better. Any show gets better the more that the people making it just follow that instinct. And we just all got more interested in basically taking the tools and taking the structures that we were using and doing personal stories and then applying them to politics and the economy and refugees and just everything else that we take on now.
Hassan says most every Afghan he knows has memorized the Skype schedule for the asylum office.
There are literally thousands of people trying at the same time right now.
25 deadening minutes pass this way. And then...
Hello.
You guys just got through. Awaz is smiling in disbelief.
It's like crazy that I've been coming here for 15 days. I cried so much, and he's so lucky. He just got it on the first day.
Hassan reaches over and grabs Awaz by the chin.
I like this guy a lot. I want to kiss him on the cheek and thank him for bringing me here, and that just because of it, it just worked out in the first day, in the first call.
I mean, we should go for it. Just kiss him on the cheek.
Wow.
He just patted his head.
When you say that this growth of memoir really exploded, did you simultaneously feel like that kind of journalism, investigative journalism, was disappearing and there was a hole for you to fill?
It's not like we felt like we were filling a hole, but there was it's funny, the investigative stuff, there are investigative journalists out there. The thing that happened is we found that when we would do journalism in our style on big issues, we were able to do stuff that the regular people weren't. Like the single hour that we did that was the most successful was this thing we did when the economy collapsed in 2008. And before, right before it collapsed, like a couple months before, we did this show basically explaining why what was going wrong and what the mortgage crisis was about. And at the time that we did it, none of us really understood any of this. And everything hadn't fallen apart yet. And Alex Wimberg, one of our producers, put this thing together, and we called it the giant pool of money.
Right. I mean, in all the coverage of this, we hadn't heard that much from the people all along the chain. We wanted to know, what were they thinking when they were doing all this? And why did they think it would work? And simply, how did it all work?
So, this is what we're devoting our program to today.
It began with this question that he really had, kind of at the height of mortgage lending before the crisis hit. And if people remember, what was going on was that banks were giving out these mortgages to basically anybody. They wouldn't.
I know, I got one.
Exactly. We could have called you.
I host a podcast. They gave me one.
Exactly. No, they would give out mortgages, and you didn't have to prove you had a job. You didn't have to put up assets. And so the reason why the mortgage crisis happened is because there were all these crappy mortgages to people who couldn't pay them back, and the banks. And what Alex was interested in is, well, why are banks doing this thing that defies the rules of the entire history of banking?
We go downstairs to see Steve Pennington, the IT guy. He points to one field, which is the most baffling one. It's just a cell on a spreadsheet, and it just has 12 letters and numbers in a row. Every letter represents a month.
What does the 9 mean?
It means they are 90 days of basically delinquent on their loan.
So, I mean, is this the Matrix, you know, where the guy's looking at the green digits passing and he's saying, oh, there's the redhead, there's the blonde. I mean, are you, Steve, seeing lives here?
I definitely see lives.
Just for the record, I see a bunch of CCCCC3636CC. I do not see a human drama.
So the drama is here is you've got someone who's been paying their loan, and then something's happened, and then they've gone 3 months delinquent, 3 months delinquent, 6 months delinquent, and then 3 months. So they basically got to this point of six, and they fought back to current.
I mean, now that I've learned the code, now that you've taught me the code, I see it. You guys are much more sympathetic, and it might be just because we're reporters and you want to make us think you're good guys, but you're really cold-hearted.
We're human beings.
I mean, these guys are hurting you. Their irresponsibility is costing you money and work.
Well, I mean, that was up to us to think about 3 years ago.
So basically, we did a story where we met people at each part along the chain. We met the people who gave out the original loans and the people who bought them. And it was interesting because very nice people brought down our entire economy. Not deplorable at all, some of them.
No.
And at each level, they explained, like, no, I knew this was going to collapse, but here's why I did what I did. Like, I knew that this mortgage was no good. I knew when I bundled this together with other mortgages, I knew it was garbage.
Good. And, like, I'm selling garbage.
I know I'm making my living. I'm getting rich off garbage. Here's how I thought about it. Here's why I and everyone else did it.
So what was the question that precipitated you going, yeah, go pursue that?
Alex was just really interested. Yeah.
So that was a huge story, and it had it had a lot of long legs and repercussions and everything else. And it's journalism. Do you consider yourself a journalist?
Yes, of course.
Well, it's not of course to me, because I think of you primarily, I guess, as a storyteller.
This is so interesting because I feel like this is like a real, this is really a thing for people who do shows that are packaged one way where they try to disguise their true intentions. I feel like it happened to Howard Stern. It happened to Garrison Keillor. Like what we do is I usually don't describe it this way. In fact, I don't think I've ever said this maybe I've said this in an interview. I don't know. But like what we do is a documentary show. But if you call something a documentary show, nobody wants to hear that. Like, I make a documentary show and I wouldn't listen to a documentary show. And so we never say it's a documentary show. We just say, like, it's stories, you know, like it'll be stories.
Now, see, that's answering the very first question I asked, which is what is the real.
Yeah, we're journalists.
It's a documentary show.
And
60 minutes for the radio.
Kind of.
But funner. But warmer.
But way more fun. It's funner. Like part of the thing that was part of the idea of the experiment of the show was can you do something that adheres to kind of the highest standards of what mission-y journalism does, where you're finding stories that nobody else is doing and getting voices on the air that nobody else is getting and documenting a part of our lives that nobody else is documenting. Can you do that with as much rigor as the best journalists do, and at the same time be out for fun? And do those things have to be a trade-off? And I feel like what we've tried to show is like, no, they don't have to be a trade-off. Something on a weekly show, on a daily show, I think really it's much harder to be as fun and to actually cover the news. Actually getting the facts of the news out is a different thing. But if you're a weekly show doing journalism, I feel like there isn't a trade-off, or there doesn't have to be. And you can make something that is just as aggressively fun as it is like holding to certain standards of journalism. So anyway, I think the fact that you don't think of me as a journalist is because...
And that did not mean that as an insult.
No.
In any way, shape, or form.
It's because we're packaging it, so it just seems like I'm a person talking and I've got a story I want to tell you.
Right.
Which, because I feel like if we come on and say it's a documentary show, it's journalism, it's serious, it doesn't sound fun. So who would listen? And it's interesting because I've seen, like, I feel like people misinterpret the packaging. Like, I saw this when Garrison Keillor retired. I feel like so many people just think it's like, oh, homespun, corny tales. When if you listen to that show is so dark and complicated, and the writing is so dark and so about so many things. And similarly with Howard Stern, like, you've been on Howard's show, and like, I'm a super fan of Howard Stern, or I assume.
Well, I have a more complicated relationship with Howard Stern, which is that I OD'd on him as a teenager because my brother listened every morning.
Right.
So I associate him with the worst years of my life because I was in high school then. And so I haven't listened to Howard Stern in years and years because it triggers me.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It takes you. Wow. That's so interesting.
Well, we're not going to talk about me, Ira. We're here to talk about you. Don't turn your journalistic lens on
me. Wait, so if
me.
We just, like, if I just would play Howard Stern right now, you would just go right back. It would be like...
Oh, my face would break out.
You would become... And who would you become?
I would like, be what failing would I see geometry. It would be terrible. I'd have a Hyundai Excel.
Your wife would just vanish. It would be like Back to the Future. It would be like, we'd have a picture of your wife, and your wife would vanish off the photograph.
That being said, being on the show was a lovely experience. He was very gracious and kind, and it was really fun.
Well, and I feel like with Howard, I feel like the packaging of the show, because he wanted to get people to listen, is all just like, it's going to be strippers and girls taking off their clothes, and it's going to be really rude. But in fact, what the show is like a bunch of people who know each other really well talking in a really intimate way. And like, once you're in it, like, you love them, like, you love each of them, and or maybe you don't love them all, but like, you have feelings about all of them, and then their dynamic is super interesting, and for super complicated reasons. Like, what they're doing is like, I mean, this is like a big word to say, but it's profound. Like, it's really. Like the day I was on,
they had mother daughter strippers.
Is that
so
true?
So I'm not sure how profound in that case.
Okay, it was. So there's a range of stuff.
Yes.
Like, you know, there's a range of stuff, and there's a range of reasons to listen. But I feel like for those of us who are hardcore fans, the reason why we come back isn't for the strippers.
Right.
You know, like, it's to hear them interact, to hear what's going on with Robin, and to hear.
So
like,
what is that? What's the equivalent for This American
Life?
Well,
I'm saying the equivalent is that people don't understand that it's journalism sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, people think it's just strippers. You know, like, it's just for fun.
But is there a connective? Well, I guess there is. You've said there is a connective tissue that sort of links show to show to show, and you've said it's this. I thought it was going to go one way, and it went another.
I mean,
another.
I don't know. That's just our staff joke. I think if you really, I hope that isn't really true. If you
but,
really
but,
look at
but
it,
there but there is an intimacy to it. There is an intimacy to This American Life.
There's a tone to it, and it's funny. Like, in the early days of the show, like, the way you get a public radio show onto public radio stations is that you have to talk every program director into picking you up.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to convince them to listen to the show, and then you have to get them to pick it up. And so it's like 500 radio stations. You do it one by one. It takes years. And in the early days, one of the things that program directors would say is, well, I don't understand, like, what this show is. Like, one week it's really funny, and the next week it's really sad, and the next week it's reporting. Like, how will the audience know what they're getting? And we would say to them, well, it's always us. Like, it's us. Like we're the same people looking at these things. And they'll just understand that it's normal to be interested in a variety of things. And I feel like that's the thing that glues it together. I feel like you can tell that I and my coworkers are approaching it always from a very particular sensibility.
I guess your career's always been somewhat journalistic. You started...
At NPR. Yeah.
But you didn't train in journalism.
No, I learned it on the job. In fact, if anything, it's funny. I had to like write a speech recently, and I was thinking about, like, well, what were the things that I really loved when I was a teenager, and I realized there were no journalists that I admired.
What teenager like admires like Edward R. Murrow?
I don't know. I think they're like Tracy Flick kind of like journalists. I think they're totally like.
But those people are the worst.
Those people are probably all that stands between us and, you know.
Tyranny?
Something. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I don't know. Like, there's certain people, like, who idolize.
So who were they?
Writers.
Who were the people that you were idolizing as a teenager?
Like, I work with people who were fans of, like, you know, like, Gay Talese and, mm-hmm. you know, and other journalists. And, oh, and Joan Didion. Like, mm-hmm. I definitely work with women who were super influenced to become journalists because they loved Joan Didion and that generation of writers. And for me, the stuff that I loved was like, as a kid, was like Broadway show tunes. and there was the only thing on the radio that I ever heard that I really loved was this old radio series. Are you old enough to remember Chicken Man?
No.
Oh, my God. Chicken Man. He's everywhere. He's everywhere. It was like these 2-minute comedy modules that were sort of very funny, like performed beautifully.
Now, another exciting episode in the life of the most fantastic crime fighter the world has ever known.
Chicken Man!
He's everywhere! They aired on 1,500 radio stations. So in between pop songs. And it was created by a guy named Dick Orkin. So in the first episode, basically a normal guy, Benton Harbor, goes, he wants to fight crime. And so, of course, the first thing you do in 1966 when they did this and Batman was on TV, the kitschy Batman TV show, is the first thing you do is you need a costume. So he goes into a costume shop to buy the costume. And then you'll just hear, it's the most deadpan. The performances are so beautiful.
Yes, may I help you?
How do you do? I'm looking for a costume.
Well, what did you have in mind?
Something that will strike terror into the hearts of criminals everywhere.
I see. Well, how about this?
No, I don't think so.
Why not try it on?
Very well.
Here, I'll help you.
Thank you.
There you are. Now, take a look in the mirror.
Not bad.
And then, like, there's a moment, especially where he goes, where he shows the costume to a criminal. And the performance of the criminal, it's like the line readings could not be funnier.
Pardon me, sir.
Yeah?
Are you by chance a vicious criminal?
Uh-huh.
Fine. Would you take a look at this costume I'm wearing?
Yeah.
Do you feel anything strange? Anything at all?
Yeah.
And what is that?
I'd like to kiss you.
Kiss me?
Yeah.
How do you account for that?
Because you look like an adorable bunny rabbit.
And so when I first wanted to do radio, I went to my college radio station. I was at Northwestern at the beginning of my college time. And I went to WNUR in the basement of some academic building, and I made promos. And all the promos I made were imitations of Chicken Man.
But what's striking about what you're telling me is that what spoke to you was radio drama.
Well, there wasn't really radio. It was comedy.
So
like
comedy.
I was into George Carlin.
Okay.
And I was into Broadway shows. You know, like I was interested in, like I loved Steve Martin.
Right.
You know, like in the, you know, people today, young people don't understand that Steve Martin was a comedian before he was an actor.
Yes, I know. Sometimes I forget that Steve Martin was a comedian before he was an actor. All right. But enough of me being a dick to people who are far more successful than me. I'm editing all of this out.
But wait, wasn't that like an alternate title for this podcast?
What?
Me being a dick to people who are more successful.
But on a serious note, full disclosure, Ira Glass did title this very podcast that you're listening to. My producers, Jen and Mary and I, went to visit Ira. We went to kiss the ring. And we said, we have this idea. Do you have any advice? And he said, what's the idea? And we said, well, we want to kind of talk about the creative process and blah, blah, blah. And he said, do you have a title? And we said, we're thinking backstory. And he said, that's a terrible title because it sounds more like a How to Be Amazing podcast. And I said, can we use that? And Ira said, go nuts. So that, thank you for titling the podcast.
Oh, but that was me just repeating back to you what you had said to me. When I said, like, what's it going to be about? You said, it's going to be about how to be amazing.
I don't think
that's
I said
a good title.
No, I did not utter those words. You're giving credit where credit is not due.
Really?
Yes, I told you what it's about, and you said that sounds like a How to Be Amazing podcast.
Oh, but I was just paraphrasing.
You were paraphrasing in a way that conveys fully why you are a terrific storyteller, and I am not. That being said.
Oh, I like your work.
Thank you. That being said.
I'm here because I'm a fan.
But I feel like in some ways your job is to, you're the guy who gives the thumbs up or thumbs down on a daily basis. In your job as, what is your title at This American life.
I'm the host. I'm the executive producer officially. But honestly,
it's more collaborative than you.
In fact, it's very like we all decide together on most things. It's not like I sit by myself and decide. Like we as a group, we talk about what we like.
But ultimately, who has the final word?
It doesn't come down to that almost ever, really.
Because you're surrounded by sycophants, and you need to know that. Somebody needs to tell you you're surrounded by sycophants.
Sometimes I wish. There have been things that I've wanted to put on the show that people are just like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. This is terrible, don't do it. And I always feel like if everybody in the room is against me, I was like, okay, I guess we're not going to do that.
Have you overruled them before?
No, not when it's like that.
Right.
No, and because they're I always come and no, they're right, and you know, like and but I, sometimes I do feel like in some way of just like, well, someday when I get my own radio show, I'm gonna put this on the radio.
Well, I mean, your history as far as I can tell, your history as a radio personality has been one of attaining increasing control. You started your own show with a friend called The Wild Room.
Right.
Those of us in coach, we started talking too, united by this shared experience we were having of sitting behind. It doesn't really compare to the Iron Curtain, but it's the polyester curtain. Listening to the people in first class who were enjoying this luxury, you know, that's what it is. It's like the ultimate luxury. What was going on up there was a party, and people were talking loudly and letting their hair down. And this is what money can really buy. The luxury of talking really loud and not caring if anybody hears at 600 miles an hour. I hadn't even gotten to the little party I was headed to. Well, this is The Wild Room. I'm Ira Glass here with my colleague Gary Covino.
Yes, Ira, and since you have obliquely raised the question of class in America, I've decided to stay and participate in the second half of this program.
And then you started This American Life, and then right. This American Life eventually left. I'm gonna get the facts wrong, but you
we were part of we were created by WBEZ Chicago,
right.
And then we hired Public Radio International as our distributor. And then
slowly shed all of that.
We shed all of that because it became unnecessary to have a distributor. We were at a point where we could just distribute ourselves. And then at some point about a year ago, we split from BEZ, WBEZ, or we stopped being, we haven't split completely. Like they're still our producing partner, but what it means now, like we used to be on their staff. And then about a year ago, it's funny, the chairman of their board suggested we become an independent company. And it's because we were getting into so many things that, we had to keep going to them for permission because we were their employees.
So if you wanted to start Serial, you had to go through...
We had to go for their permission, yeah. And also because... Yeah, exactly. Like, if we wanted to start... And truthfully, like, they would say, like, well, you guys know what you're doing. like, we don't need supervision at this point. Like, you know, and so I would have to call the chairman of the board to get permission to do, like... And even things like... you know, sometimes there would be something like somebody... there's a director named Lynn Shelton, incredible director... she wanted to adapt one of our stories into a movie, and then we wanted to pay a screenwriter the base level fee that you pay a screenwriter under the union, whatever, to like write the screenplay on spec or not on spec. We were paying them the union rate, and then we were going to take it out and try to get it to a studio and blah blah blah. That was, you know, tens of thousands, not many tens, of maybe $30,000. Mm. Okay, and we had a surplus that year because we were making money off podcasting, so we had $30,000, and I had to call the chairman of the board to say like, okay, so there's the screenwriter, blah, 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 $30,000. And then the idea is they'll write the screenplay. It's a great director. The great director, Green Shelton, was going to write it with a fellow writer and another great writer, actually. And so because this isn't in the mission of the public radio show, I can't just do this without anybody saying yes. Somebody on the board has to say yes. And he said to me, like, something's wrong.
Right.
He says, like, I am completely unqualified to judge whether this is a good investment or not. Also, like, you have the money, like you have the extra money. So if you lose the money and it's all a mistake, it doesn't matter. And I'm being asked to like weigh in on a decision that has no consequence. And you should just be free to make these decisions and do this stuff. And so now our relationship with BEZ is their name is on the show and we do special stuff with them. And I do their pledge drives and I do fundraising with them. And they get money from us, but we're not part of the company.
So it was an amicable divorce.
It was a very amicable divorce. And so
but
now,
you have full custody of the child, more
yes,
or less.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is great.
And it's nice. It's nice. Like, I feel like since that time, we've done, I've been touring in a dance show. We made Birbiglia's film.
Don't Think Twice, which I have seen twice and
right.
love.
We've done the second season of Serial. We have some other podcasts that we're working on that we hope to be rolling out soon, and have other projects and things in the work. It's been lovely, and it's been nice. But that said, like within the company, within This American Life, it's very much like we all figure it out together. I feel like that's the strength of it.
I don't know why I don't I'm going to challenge you, and there's just an instinct in me that wants to challenge you, because I absolutely believe that you believe that This American Life is totally collaborative, but part of me, there's a nagging part of me that's going, come on, Ira is it's his baby, and I guess I wonder whether either you're being totally honest with me or totally honest with yourself, or I'm just wrong and it really is as collaborative as you say.
I mean, the day-to-day experience of making it is very collaborative. I mean, there are places where, like, I definitely get the last word, but they're on things like listening to the final mixes of the show, which basically takes my entire day on Friday. We broadcast on Friday nights and put our show up on the public radio satellite. And so basically from, like, 8 in the morning until the show is fed on Friday, I'm, like, listening to mixes and giving the most minute kinds of, like, you know, move this voice up for 0.3 seconds and start the music here and not here, and, like, this is too loud here. Like I spend my entire day doing that.
That's so boring.
It's so boring. It is honestly so boring, but so important. Like, honestly, like, it totally
I'm sure
affects
it is.
The feeling. It's like mixing a movie or something. Like, it really affects, like, all those little things. And often being, like, you know, like, go back and retract this one phrase in their script and, you know, re-record this thing and just all this little thing. I mean, maybe that could be where I'm living in a world of illusion. It really doesn't matter. But, like, in my mind, it matters. And so that part, I definitely insist on having the last word, because I have a thing that I'm hearing in my head that I want to hear. But in the stages up to then, like there have been so many shows that I was like, I don't know, I'm not into this. If you are, like, let's try it and let's see. And then those turn out to be the thing that win awards and that everybody loves. And we won the Peabody Award on 2 things that I thought we shouldn't do. That's not a joke. That's the truth. One in particular was about a massacre in Guatemala. I was like, I don't know. It's about a massacre, and it's news that everybody who cares to know about the history of Guatemala already knows it, and it's not in English. And it was just like,
I can promise you not everybody knows the history of Guatemala. I can promise you, because you're
Let's
talking...
take a poll on the street.
We can take a poll in this room, and one of us is going to raise his hand and one of us is not.
Okay. Let me just ask you. Okay. In Guatemala in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Massacres?
Sure.
Well, today on our radio show, we have investigators trying to solve an unsolved murder of more than 200 people from the 1980s in a case that could potentially nudge the political climate of their entire country. And finally, hold military officials responsible for massacres that happened there. Just this week, the former president of the country was indicted for genocide in this case. And at the center of the whole thing is a guy, Oscar Ramirez, who discovers that everything he thought about his past, his dad, who he really is all a lie.
One of the many points that is clear from talking to Ira Glass is that success takes a lot of hard work. He spent years devoted to honing his journalistic voice until finally striking out on his own with This American Life, at which point the work became even more intense. Are you sensing a theme here? Coming up, we talk more about his early years working as a journalist and the challenges of being the boss. Then he turns his focus to this show and lets us know how we can do better, and damn him, he's right. Did you have to learn how to be a manager of people?
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good question. Yeah, totally. Yeah, like when I started, I had never managed anybody, and I was bad at it. I was actively bad at it.
What were you doing that was bad?
I feel ashamed of things that I did now, because I basically...
Please tell us all of those things.
Good instincts. Okay. I don't know why I'm critiquing the interview while we're doing it, but I was mean. I was accidentally mean because to me, I felt like, well, it's obvious how this should go. Like, it's obvious that, like, this should come before this. Like, it's like, how could you not know that? Like, listen to the tape. Like, it's obvious that, like, they should do this and they should do this. like, I mean, it wasn't quite as awful as I'm saying right now all the time, but, like, and was encouraging often. But I think, like, we were under, it was a tiny staff. We were turning out a huge amount of material. It was four of us making the show. Now it's, you know, a dozen. So you could see, like, it's really different if it's four of you and we had no money. And all we did was work on the, like, any minute I was either working on the show or I was sleeping. Those were the only two things I did for 4 or 5 years. And I just didn't understand about managing people. I really, and honestly, like, to the credit of the people who I worked with at the beginning, they just said, like, do this differently. Like, they just totally got me into shape where I feel like I'm not the greatest now, but I feel like I'm decent to work for.
Meanness seems like counterintuitive.
And then kind of like accidental mean. Like, I wasn't like vindictive. Like, it was just like I was impatient with people all the time in a way that was mean, I think. I mean, not even all the time. But like, I wasn't used to being in charge of other people, you know, and I really had to learn what that is. And also to, like, give people space. And, like, at some point 2 or 3 years into the show, I realized, like, I can't do this all, run the whole thing myself. It's just too much editing to do. Like, nobody could do it. And I decided, like, one of these people has to be my peer. And basically, Julie Snyder was the obvious choice. And she and I basically ran the show. And so, like, at the point where she was running the thing with me, like, it all became so much better. And we were sharing the responsibility and I wasn't doing everything. Like, I think I was just holding on to every decision at the beginning because that's what I had always done. I had always worked for myself or I had produced other people's work, you know, in little pieces and things. Like, you know, I'd produce Robert Siegel or Renee Rantaine on All Things Considered. Like, I was be the person who goes with them in the field. And there, just working with one person is pretty easy. They're very skilled and, you know, you just manage stuff. You just take care of it.
This may be shitty to do. I don't know. But you talked about you being mean.
Yeah.
And then in my research of you, I have unearthed things that people have said about you, specifically old girlfriends and whatever, and they don't portray you great. Your old partner in the wild room. I guess you had a somewhat...
There were three of us, and there was my friend Gary.
Yeah, and you had a very, it seems like, at least from his point of view, very tempestuous split because he...
Yes, 21 years ago, yes.
Well... But I didn't know about this, so I'm curious about it. The show itself that you were producing, The Wild Room, he says was essentially what this American life was, just without him. You maintained that it really had nothing to do with it.
Yes.
I guess my question is...
Wait, let me respond to that part, because that sounds so awful when you say it.
Oh, it sounds terrible.
The Wild Room was
going to edit out your response. I'm just going to make you into a monster.
So this is why you've brought me here. The show he and I were doing was a freeform radio show.
Explain what that is, because I don't really understand what freeform radio is.
It was a live freeform. We would basically go into
You're improvising.
We're improvising.
Got it.
We would come into the studio with like a vague, well, not a vague plan, a plan, some weeks more vague than others, and clips to play each other and things to talk about and tape to play each other and guests. And then we would freestyle it for an hour. That's not the same as a completely produced documentary program where every single second of it is planned and fought over and edited and re-edited. And, you know, it's not the same show. And I think he said some things when I went off to do my own show. And without him, I think he felt bad and just said a lot of things that I would hope in retrospect he would understand like they aren't.
You never reconciled?
No. No.
Well, we have a surprise for you. Gary?
It's so sad that you're laughing about that.
I'm just laughing that I would really do that.
He's not a real person.
I'm not laughing at him. I would never laugh at him. I'm just laughing at the idea that I would spring this on you in that horrible manner. I would never do that. But when you were doing that show, were you feeling those creative limitations? Were you consciously aware that the improvisational aspect of it was limiting for you? Or is that even an accurate description of what you were going through?
No, I mean, I really love I really loved doing that show. I mean, I did that show for 5 years, and I did that show as an excuse to hang out with my friend on the radio. And also, like, there were things that I wanted to figure out. Like, one of the things that I figured out doing that show is that before I did that show, I sounded on the air like every NPR reporter in a very sort of very straight, very formal way. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do a live radio show was to train myself out of it so I would sound like I sound now. Like, it was a conscious decision to change the way I sound on the air. And I would do sometimes pieces that sound like what I do now, where I talk and I play clips of tape and there's music running underneath. I mean, that's the part that's similar. I tried out those experiments on The Wild Room.
Daryl Strong was a guy who was wandering around. He had better equipment. He had two cameras and a bag of camera stuff. Now, he makes it his hobby to photograph Democratic presidential candidates, all the Democrats. He's got these pictures all over his basement, he told me.
I like to take the pictures of the Democrats.
Why?
Well, because I'm a Democrat nut, I guess.
But, I mean, to have a hobby of taking pictures of Democrats, given the record of Democratic candidates in presidential elections over the last two decades, it's almost like being a Chicago Cubs fan or something.
I am that, too.
Did you have aspirations at that time of doing something more?
You knew
that you wanted to graduate into...
I'm so sorry. Can I reach over and just... You're not totally on beam with your microphone.
Holy shit. I can't believe you're doing this.
There. Okay, there. You were just a little off axis.
Uplip.
Here, wait. I'll show you. You were kind of over here, and now you're here. Like,
you guys, this is the ultimate Ira Glass moment. Now you're off axis. You're laughing off axis. What were those aspirations? Did you have any kind of? Did you know what form you wanted to take it?
No. But I knew that I wanted it to be a show that had. There was a certain kind of feeling to a story that I knew I wanted. And it is the feeling of the stories we make now. Though, honestly, I couldn't make them as well as we do now at all. And
I would hope you would have gotten better.
Yeah, totally did. And before I started the show, like, I sent out grant applications, you know, to different places and got turned down. And, like, you know, people didn't want to make it. And finally, like, you know, I talked somebody into giving me a few $1,000s to make 3 pilots. Like, I have a picture of, like, somebody could do a show. And if I had to have expressed it at that time, I would have just said, like, they would be stories about everyday people, and they would just kind of pull you in and give you a feeling. And there were pieces that I did.
And if you pitched that to me, I would say, no, thank you.
It's good. Right, and people did say no, thank you. In fact,
no, it's going to be everyday people. It's going to pull you in, and you'll feel a certain way. Oh, great, Ira.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what it is.
That is kind of what it is, yeah.
You've talked about taste and how creative people have good taste. And you know that you have this good taste, but maybe you haven't caught up to your own taste in terms of how to express it. How did you trust your own taste? Because I know even 20 years into my career, 25 years, I don't trust my own taste at all.
You're talking about there's a thing that I said like in an interview years ago that kind of got just passed around,
yeah.
which is that I said, like, when you're beginning, nobody tells you, like, it's normal to be bad.
Right.
Like, and that is totally the truth. And I was bad for a really long time. And like, I wasn't competent at writing and performing radio stories until, I started when I was 19, and I wasn't really decent until I was 28.
Mm-hmm.
And that's me working hard to try to do it. Like, I was just a stiff, and I was a bad interviewer, and I was a bad writer, and I couldn't perform well. And I think that a lot of people who want to do creative work, they go through this period where the work is just not – the stuff they're making, they know it isn't as good as what they want to make. And that's the thing I'm just trying to describe. It's the gap between your ambition, the feeling that you have of, like, I want to do this thing. There's this person whose work I love. I want it to be like that. But what you're making is nowhere near that. And you know it. Like, you know it when you make it.
So did you ever lose faith that you would one day reach that level where you would be satisfied with the work?
I never had any faith that I would reach that level.
Really?
Like
for, so what keeps you going then? If you're sucking day in and day in and day out, how do you persist in that if you don't have faith that at some point you'll get good at this thing?
There were two things. And one is that... there was a part of it that I really enjoyed. I was a really good editor from the very beginning. It's the one skill I had. And so I liked that part of it and was good at that part of it.
And this is back when editing meant something, when you had to cut the tape.
Yes, that's true. But conceptually, like, it's all, right. it's still exactly the same. And honestly, like most of my job now is I'm an editor. Like, mm-hmm. most of the week I'm spending, you know, listening to stories and doing revisions and things like that. So the editing part I had, and that part was always fun. And so I had that. There was a part of it that was fun while there were all these other parts that I was terrible at. And then the other thing that kept me going was I was just lying to myself. I mean, it's funny, like just recently I dug up this story that I had always remembered as being the turning point story for me. And I did it in 1986, and I was 27 years old, and I had been at it for 8 years at that point. And it wasn't a story on anything important, but I remember this is a story where I finally felt like, oh, I got it. Oh, I figured out how to be a reporter. Hmm. And I sound good. And I dug it up, and it was about the 75th anniversary of the Oreo cookie. and in that story, and I had never listened to it. I hadn't listened to it in you know, since then. Like, and I'm just terrible.
This year, the Oreo is 75 years old, and Nabisco Brands, which manufacture the cookie, is spending millions on special birthday promotions. Ira Glass reports this effort comes at a time when Oreos face new, aggressive competition in the cookie aisle.
John Bagley looks on Oreos with what could almost be described as patriotic zeal.
It's like apple pie and Chevrolet and Oreos. It's part of America. You know, I feel very, very proud to be part of it.
Mr. Bagley is production manager for Oreos at Nabisco's plant in Fairlawn, New Jersey, one of five U.S. factories that bake the world's most popular brand of cookie.
There was a confidence to the presentation. Like, I was just able to, like, I don't know. Honestly, like I felt like I was nailing all these great things. There's one sentence in it that I remember writing that I remember thinking, like, nailed it. And that sentence was in there. And I can tell you what it is. At one point I say something where it's sort of like, in the time it takes me to finish this sentence, this machine makes this number of Oreo cookies, and whatever the number is. I was like, that is so clever.
The cream is added by three spinning drums, one behind another on the assembly line. The first drum places a row of chocolate wafers face down on the conveyor belt. The second drum squirts cream on the wafers. The third drops a face-up wafer on top. In the time it takes me to finish this sentence, this machinery turns out 400 Oreos.
Would Ira Glass, executive producer and host of This American Life, fire Ira Glass 5 years into his tenure of making shitty stories for Morning Edition or whatever you were making? Would you have let yourself continue?
I never would. It has occurred to me a number of times that if 25-year-old me or 30-year-old me were applying for a job on This American Life, I would not get the job.
Right.
I never would have been hired.
You wouldn't even have been hired, let alone fired.
No.
So what are you looking for? I mean, who do you hire?
I'm looking for somebody who's more talented than I was. like honestly, you know, I had some good instincts, but I couldn't make decent radio stories yet. Like, everybody who I hire is more talented than I was in my 20s.
Who's a typical This American Life hire? Like, they went to Vassar. They published in Plowshares or whatever.
Lesbian. Oh my God. I mean, like, people come to us from other public radio shows. I mean, lately, you know, we've been pilfering the Planet Money staff, so it's some of the most experienced reporters in radio. So
Planet Money was a spun off from This American Life, right? But you don't own it or control it?
We don't own it. It was owned by NPR. Uh-huh. So David Kestenbaum, Zoe Chace, Lana Jaffe Walt, like, three of the most talented people making radio in the country. We're like the New York Yankees at this point. We can just, like, you know, invite the most talented people. It's an, I don't know. I said that and it sounds awful, actually.
But it's true.
Ugh, I feel bad that I just said that on a podcast. Okay, whatever. It's the truth. Okay, and then I'm in.
This podcast by comparing my show to a rutted dirt road, and yours to a pristine superhighway. So don't get falsely modest on me now.
I was just yes anding. Excuse me. I was just being a team player and yes anding your premise when I did that.
My impassable road. If you drive into it wrong, your car will be flooded.
Never get out. So then there's people like that. And then there's people who've never done radio. We hired this filmmaker named Neil Drumming, who's amazing and has done such beautiful stories for us. And this reporter, Karen Duffin, who's been in the public radio system, who's just done some amazing stories for Radiolab and other people. And, you know, just like it's a mix of people at kind of different levels.
Do you ever consciously look for people who break whatever the mold of a This American Life staff person is?
Over the last few years, we have consciously made the staff less white, and now it is much less white.
Oh, I wasn't even necessarily thinking white.
Well, no, but I'm saying like that's been a total project. I feel like it was the whole show was too white, and now not so much, not as much at all.
What's the best and worst advice you've ever received?
The voice. Is that a question you ask everybody?
Usually. Full disclosure.
Wait, what's full disclosure? The people in the
Because they want me to ask it every time, and usually people don't have good responses to it. So my instinct is to just not ask it, but I want to make them happy.
That you're pointing at your producers in the behind
That's
the
right.
glass booth here.
Jennifer and Mary, who are lovely.
It's interesting because there's a whole class of interview questions that are better than anyone can produce an answer for, mm-hmm. and that is squarely in that tradition.
Thank you. So would your advice as a This American Life producer be to drop that question?
Well, it's an intimidating question, first of all, because it's a compound question.
Uh-huh.
What's the best and worst advice?
Right.
First of all, I would suggest split them up.
Okay.
And don't make it the best advice. I would say just like, what's some good advice somebody gave you?
Well, see, here's a spin on it I've been doing sometimes
okay.
that I think works much
yeah,
better.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to somebody starting out in your profession?
Oh, see, that's a good one because you can
Thank
answer
you.
That. Okay.
Thank you. Now, I'm being passive aggressive because I haven't said to them, I don't like this question.
Oh, this is the first discussion
I have
having?
The courage to
what
do it
What are you
here?
Like as a boss?
Oh, I'm not a boss.
you're the boss to this podcast,
no,
aren't
not.
You?
I don't think so. Would you say I'm the boss? I wouldn't.
He's
no, she's saying
window.
No.
He's looking through the window at his producer. Producer shook her head no.
Jen said no. No, I feel the same way that it's very collaborative. And yeah. I've never put my foot down about anything. And I don't even really listen to the edits because I can't stand
You
myself.
Can't stand to hear your voice?
It's the same thing.
But
I'm better. I'm
learn,
actually.
But then you don't learn.
I'm better
works.
At. Let me finish. I've gotten better at listening for precisely that reason. For precisely that reason, to teach myself.
I can't believe you just shouted at me.
Oh yeah.
Now I feel
it probably
like
won't
I
be
understand.
The last time. I'll probably shout at you on the way up.
Now I just want to like think of things to say to you to make you shout more and get you madder and madder.
What advice would you give to somebody?
I mean, honestly, the main advice I would give would be just do it now. Don't wait. Like, don't make it. There's so easy to make an excuse to like put off like making the thing you want to make if you're doing a creative job, and just like start making it. Just start making it. Like put yourself on a deadline. Make a ton of work. Show it to people whose opinion you trust. Take their notes, just be on a path to make yourself better. Another thing I would advise people who are going into radio is get people who know how to make radio to hear your stuff and give you notes. When I was a baby reporter, I couldn't afford grad school.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about going to journalism grad school, but I couldn't afford it. So instead, I would pay NPR reporters who I liked $50 to read my scripts
Aww.
And tell me what I was doing wrong.
And they would take the $50.
They would totally. And they gave me advice. Honestly, there are things that I learned that I use to this day.
Oh, I'm sure. I just find it kind of sad that they would take the $50 from some kid who clearly didn't have the $50. But I guess you pay people for
their
work.
I was paying them for their time.
Yeah. No, I think it's very generous of you. I think it's kind of dickish for them.
God, it never even occurred to me. Like literally... Until this moment, I never thought about it. If some 22-year-old would be like, I'll give you $50 to sit with me for half an hour and go through this
script.
Oh,
half an hour.
Like, would I cash that check?
Of course not. Do you ever find it?
Oh, wait. I thought of the worst advice I've got.
Oh, wow.
And it was don't host the show. And truthfully, like when I started the show, I really thought that I should get somebody else to host it, but I couldn't afford to hire anybody.
As I end this episode, I will end it the way I end every episode, and this I really do every episode, The Amazing Five, where I will give you five categories of things, and I'll just ask for a recommendation for our listeners.
Oh, God damn it. I've heard your podcast, and I realized that this was coming, and then I totally forgot.
Oh, I'm
and
thrilled.
I could have prepared.
I'm thrilled that you didn't.
I totally could have prepared.
Food.
My favorite food?
Yeah.
I mean, I like Brussels sprouts prepared in any way, almost.
Steamed.
Steamed, yeah.
Really?
With salt. I mean, it's better if there's like butter and if it's a little greasy, but yeah, Brussels sprouts.
What is Brussels sprout season?
I have no idea.
I don't either.
I don't grow them.
Right.
Well, I just eat them.
They're available all year round now, but I just thought maybe there's a time when they're better than others.
I'm not that into them.
Brussels sprouts is your food recommendation book.
Wait, am I recommending these or am I saying what my favorites are? Those are two different things.
However you interpret it. I asked for a recommendation.
You asked for a recommendation.
You interpreted it as
a recommendation.
Favorite.
Oh, let me think about a recommendation. Sorry, a recommendation would be different.
Why can't it be Brussels sprouts? Why can't you recommend
Everybody's
Brussels?
Everybody's tried Brussels sprouts and they either like them or they don't. Well, it's like recommending Coca-Cola.
But people are interested in what Ira Glass likes to eat. And so in a sense, by saying it's your favorite, it's also a recommendation. People will say, oh, I always thought I hated Brussels sprouts, but I like Ira Glass so much. Then perhaps I should give Brussels sprouts another try.
I don't want America eating more Brussels sprouts.
Jacking up the price of Brussels sprouts. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah.
Do you want to give a favorite instead? I mean, a recommendation instead of a favorite? Or are you satisfied with Brussels sprout?
Let's move on to the next one. Okay. I don't have anything interesting to say about food because I don't care about food.
Okay. You seem very thin right now, I have to say.
I've been touring in a dance show. So
I know. And I wish we had had time to talk about the dancing.
Right.
Book.
Recommend a book?
Yeah.
The book that I recommended on the radio show is this book called Being a Beast by this writer named Charles Foster, and basically he goes and lives as five different animals, and it's a sincere. It's not a stunt. It is like a lifelong
obsession.
How is
that not
obsession.
A stunt?
It's
How
so
is that not,
not
a stunt?
A stunt. If you read the book, you'd see he is actually trying to understand what it is like to be these animals and to get as close as he can to their experience. And so when he's a badger, he gets very low to the ground, and uses smell instead of sight. I know it sounds ridiculous, and yet. He's a beautiful writer.
I'm sure he is.
So
and I'm
like
going to read it.
And then the other book that I read recently that I just loved, to name a book that I would totally recommend to anybody who like makes shows of any kind, is there's a book called Wonder of Wonders about Fiddler on the Roof.
Hmm.
And it's about the making of Fiddler on the Roof. And I read it because I saw the production of Fiddler that's on Broadway, which was interesting for a bunch of reasons. One is Danny Bernstein, who plays the lead, just plays it so real. It's the part of the lead of Fiddler on the Roof is usually played in a very shticky way. And he plays it in a way where the guy is such a real guy in this way where you so appreciate it just to watch him. And I cried through like the first half of it because I realized while I was watching it that my mom took me to see Fiddler on the Roof over and over. We were East Coast Jews. And when I grew up, like literally like every year growing up in suburban Baltimore, there are a lot of Jews there. And a production of Fiddler on the Roof would come through. So I saw Herschel Bernardi. I saw Topol. I think I might have seen Zero Mostel, but Maybe I'm just kidding myself about that. So it's so many times. And when I was watching it, I realized I don't just know all the songs because we had the Broadway album, but I knew all the punchlines to the jokes and I knew all the setups to the jokes. And I realized I knew all the dialogue. Like people would walk into scenes and I would know what they were going to say. I haven't seen the show since I was a teenager 40 years ago. And I was like, my mom took me to Fiddler on the Roof so much. Like, I had it memorized and in me ready. And my mom passed about 10 years ago. And I just thought, honestly, the thought has occurred to me that what I do was so shaped by the Broadway shows that my mom took me to. And that, in this weird way, when I got into journalism, all I tried to do was make a program, make shows, make stories that are basically Fiddler on the Roof, where they're funny at the beginning and you get attached to these characters and they might be just like you, but they might be very different than you. And then it's about a bigger something, like Fiddler on the Roof is about a bigger something.
And if our good fortune ever comes, here's to whatever comes.
And it'll be funny at the beginning, and then it'll be really sad at the end. and my entire attempt to make journalism, at some point I just wasn't making journalism like other people because I was trying to make it feel like Fiddler on the Roof, which I didn't realize till in retrospect. And sitting there, I just thought, like, if my mom, like, knew, like, this, like, I don't know, knew I was here and thinking about her. And I don't know, I think when you're a parent, you throw a lot of stuff at your kids wondering what's going to stick, and those shows meant so much to her. And the fact that, like, it took and that basically make a show, which is that. And then the fact that I, like, even worked with, like, Lin-Manuel Miranda, mm-hmm. when I made a musical with, like, a real guy who makes musicals, you know, I mean, a little one, like, not one that's on Broadway or anything, but, like I had that experience. When I saw Fiddler on the Roof, I was with one of the people who was in Lin's musical, Lindsay Mendez, who's a Broadway star. She was starred in Wicked, and she knew somebody in the cast, so we went backstage. I just thought, like, my mom knew, like, I was at a Broadway show, and I went backstage and met people in the cast, you know what I mean? So I told somebody, he says, you got to read this book. And Fiddler on the Roof is just like a perfect piece of drama. Like just structurally, there's comedy all the way through it, even in the saddest scenes. And basically what the book is it details all the attempts to turn the original Shalom Aleichem stories that these are based on, all the attempts to turn it into a Broadway show, into a successful piece of theater, including by Shalom Aleichem when he was alive. He came to New York and tried to do it himself and couldn't do it. And what's beautiful about it, if you make things for a living, is that what a terrible job they're doing at first. They write so many more songs that they end up using, and the beginning of the show didn't make sense to people. And, like, the woman who writes it does such a beautiful job going through, like, here's all the stuff they tried that failed on the way to this thing that's just, like, a perfect gem. And I feel like I've never read anybody write about the making of a show, writing about this thing that I do every single week, about, like, all the dumbass stuff you do on your way to it being good. We make so much, we do so many more interviews than end up on the air. We kill half of everything we try. Like on Monday of the week, my idea of what the show will be is often very different from what it is on Friday. Like, we change stories. We kill stories the day before and throw in other things. And it was so exciting to read that about this show that I turns out I have memorized. Okay, what's next on the five? Have I spent too long on the two and we've no. just dropped the next three?
I mean, I was kind of tempted to because it's not going to get any more beautiful
no,
than that.
No, let's just stop.
No,
let's call it.
I'm not going to. Movie or television?
I think that Louis C.K.'s TV show Horace and Pete is totally somehow got overlooked by America and the world, and I'm not all the way through. I'm only on episode three, but I have to say I'm enjoying it at exactly the level it's pitched. And the acting is amazing, including Alan Alda playing a dick. Have you seen this?
No.
Oh, my God.
Because it's just one of those things that seemed too hard to just kind of access.
You go on the internet and you type in Horace and Pete, and you're there in 1 second.
But don't I have to pay for it? And the idea of, like, giving Louis C.K. my credit card number doesn't seem smart. I don't know.
You mean he's going to download porn with it or what?
Maybe. I mean, it's one of those things that I absolutely have every intention of watching and just haven't done so yet.
I swear.
Like, but like with Brussels sprouts, this may be enough to get to motivate
you
to do that.
I have to say, like Adie Bryant plays his daughter, and the scenes between him and Adie Bryant, I was just like, oh my God, Adie. I mean, she's in other stuff and she's always good. But, like, they are so real. Like, the scene between him and his daughter, she's so, like, it's one of those scenes where, like, the grown daughter is kind of, like, rolling her eyes at her dad but trying to be good with him but having a hard time being good with him. And they're both such good actors in the scene. And, like, it's just scene after scene, and the cast is amazing. I was saying Alan Alda plays this racist, homophobic dick. And with such relish. And I don't know if you, like, I love Alan Alda, and, like, I love that in his, like, after MASH, he's just like, I'm tired of playing nice guys. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm going to play a dick. And I feel like he does it so great. And Edie Falco plays his sister, and some of the scenes with Edie Falco, even if you watch the first two and you just don't feel like, oh my God, good for you, Louis C.K. And he's just, like, inventing this thing on the fly that nobody wanted and nobody asked for. I mean, like, that's, I love that when somebody's just like, nobody in the world wants this but me, and, like, I'm just going for it. And you just feel that spirit in it. You just feel like he's inventing this thing. It's just so interesting. Like, I don't know. It's that. So that's my recommendation.
Music.
Music. I know nothing about this person, but I heard, because it came up on, like, the whatever I'm listening to on the phone when I'm in the gym. L. King, or his name may even be pronounced Ella King, and I heard the song X's and O's, And I've written about this somewhere, so I'm just going to repeat what I wrote about it. But I know nothing about her. But what I like about her just makes me seem old, and that is that she's doing a very old-fashioned 1950s soul kind of thing, but in a contemporary music setting that is designed to sound very old.
1, 2, 3, they're gonna run back to me, 'cause I'm the best baby that they never gotta keep. 1, 2, 3, they're gonna run back to me. They always wanna come, but they never wanna leave. Except
the drum track is super new sounding, but everything else about it sounds like 1950s. And she's got this hoarse, sort of whiskey driven voice, and like, and her whole album. I just think she's great. And I feel like she, I know nothing about her. Have you ever heard of her?
Yeah, I know the song. Does she also sing America's Sweetheart?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so I may be mistaken here, but I'm 99% sure I'm not. That is Rob Schneider's daughter.
Wow.
Isn't that shocking?
Wow. Is that real? For real?
I'm going to Google it, but I think...
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for her, man. Good for her.
I know, but that feels very incongruous, but fantastic. Yeah. And then finally...
Wait, do you think her career would be better if she just totally hid that? Like, if nobody knew that? If
that's like such a weird... I don't think she's advertising it, necessarily.
But like the fact that I bring her up, and then you're like, that's the first thing you say, and then I
feel
like...
Because it's so weird.
Well, it's so weird, because he signifies so randomly, and so not the marketing
exactly.
that she is. Like, yeah, wow. Well, good for her.
And then finally, miscellaneous, anything from your life that you would recommend to other people?
Do you want to record that differently just in case you need to move the fiddler on the roof to the end so you don't say finally at the beginning of that sentence?
Oh. God damn you, Ira Glass. Miscellaneous. Anything from your life you would recommend to other people?
I think I was laughing. You have to record it again.
Miscellaneous. Anything from your life you would recommend to other people, Ira Glass?
You know what I think it just happened? I think we just actually said so much about the order of things.
We have to keep it the same.
It's stay in this order
as
now,
soon as you said that, I knew we were keeping it the same.
All right.
Are you difficult
really?
To live
wow.
with?
What?
Like, does this kind of nitpicking, does this enter your relationship with your wife?
Not this kind, no.
Miscellaneous. Anything from your life you would recommend to other people?
I really should have listened to the podcast more recently because I could have totally prepared material
What I find is the first thing that comes to people's minds, they tend to, and you can see it in their eyes, they tend to dismiss it as trivial or stupid. But that's the thing that I want.
I'm drinking a lot of Manhattans.
I mean, perfect.
And made with rye on ice.
What comprises a Manhattan?
A Manhattan, basically, it's one part... rye in the way that I think you should make it. And then there's a sweet part. Basically, what makes it a perfect drink is that the rye really has kind of an edge and a kick to it. And then you use vermouth, sweet vermouth, and you put in, like, if the rye is one shot, you do like half of a shot of vermouth or a little more if you want a little sweeter. And then a dash of bitters or not. Like, I don't make it with the bitters sometimes. And then you want a good maraschino cherry, and that's where you really want it to, like, spend the extra money. And
I will say a good maraschino cherry is a contradiction in terms.
There's one company that makes these maraschino cherries called Luxardo, or maybe it's Luxardo, and they actually make the whole idea of a maraschino cherry seem delicious. And so, for example, last week was kind of a stressful week, and every day I went home and I made one of those for myself, and thought, maybe this is a bad sign of how things are going for me, that I'm making a mixed drink when I walk into the house, like it's 1953 and I'm
sure.
Don Draper or something. But I was just like, I'm just going to go with this as a lifestyle experiment. And I felt pretty good about it.
Good. Ira Glass, thank you for taking extra time. You took a lot of time today. I appreciate it. And thank you for all the work and hours of pleasure that you've given me and so many millions of listeners on your information superhighway podcast.
This part is boring.
And thank you for being amazing.
Thank you.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show and check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Robin Lynn with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.